Welcome to another captivating episode of The Dark State. Today we are honoured to have Calder Walton joining us to discuss his book Spies, The Epic Intelligence War Between East and West. Calder is one of the world's leading intelligence scholars. A historian at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, he received his doctorate in history from Trinity College in Cambridge, where he also helped to write the authorized history of MI5. Get ready for an exploration into the clandestine operations that have shaped the course of geopolitics, espionage, and the delicate dance between Russia and the West over the past century. I'm John Mooney, and welcome to The Dark State. Calder, it's a real pleasure to have you on The Dark State. Your book is a seminal work. Just before we dive in, could I ask you, how long did it take you to write it?
Well, John, first of all, thank you for having me on. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. The book took me 7 years to write. Two of those years, though, was, as we all remember, during COVID, which meant that the archives I was using were closed. So I probably could have done it quicker, but it took 7 years. So let's just put it this way. My wife was glad when the book was finished.
Okay. Well, I can't recommend it enough. And I normally don't endorse books or products or anything on the show, but this is a must have for every one of our listeners. So I'm going to begin with our first question, which is Spies covers the century-long intelligence war between Russia and the West. Can you maybe explain to the listeners how cloak and dagger espionage has played a pivotal role in equalizing the power dynamics between global players?
Absolutely. Well, for 100 years and counting, Russia, the Kremlin, has been using intelligence in ways to punch far above its weight militarily. So when the Bolsheviks seized power in Moscow in 1917, and then when the wartime First World War allies intervened in the subsequent Russian Civil War, the Soviet state that emerged out of that was extraordinarily fragile, extraordinarily weak. And it sort of embedded within the Bolshevik communist-Leninist outlook was a belief of the absolute critical importance in cloak and dagger operations. And within that, it was seen as absolutely imperative by Lenin and then Stalin and then his successors to do anything and everything possible to obtain, yes, political intelligence on their ideological adversaries in the West, particularly Britain and then increasingly the United States, but also to steal as many scientific and technological secrets from Western powers as possible. And what was their purpose in doing this? It was to prepare themselves, the Soviet state, for what they saw as the inevitable, using that in air commas, in according to their Marxist reading, the inevitable conflict with Western capitalist powers. So this was across different fields, across domains, but the most important element in that first half of the 20th century, the biggest target and the most successful achievement was Soviet intelligence stealing the secrets of the world's first atomic bomb at the Manhattan Project. So your listeners may have seen the fantastic movie Oppenheimer. If not, I highly recommend it. The Christopher Nolan does depict one of the Soviet spies in Los Alamos. That's Klaus Fuchs in the film, but there were many others. And what did the Soviet intelligence services do? Well, this is really the high watermark of what I was just describing. Stealing the secrets of the world's first atomic bomb meant that the Soviet scientists were able to accelerate their project, their own project, to develop a atomic bomb. It developed research and development, and it meant that 4 years after the Americans detonated their atomic weapons, dropping them on Japan, the Soviet Union detonated its first atomic weapon. And at that point, we have this superpower, nuclear-armed superpower standoff between East and West, that was the essence of the Cold War.
Your book emphasizes the importance of leadership in espionage. And it really does take a deep dive into this and how personalities can influence and direct intelligence collection and how intelligence agencies behave. So figures like Vladimir Lenin and others shaped this 100-year intelligence war. What role does leadership play in the success or failure of such clandestine operations like this?
Well, I think it's absolutely essential, and it's particularly essential, it seems to me, in one-party states, both past and present. So one of the absolutely striking things that we see when we look at Soviet intelligence records smuggled out of the former Soviet Union, I'm talking about the so-called Matryokhin Archive, which was... Matryokhin was the KGB first chief foreign intelligence directorate archivist and amassed an archive of top secret intelligence records. This was exfiltrated by MI6 out of the Soviet Union as it collapsed. And what this extraordinary archive reveals, and portions of it are publicly available in archives in Cambridge in the UK, what it reveals is how essential the different personalities of the Soviet leadership were to its intelligence services. The most obvious example is the way Stalin completely and utterly mishandled intelligence that was coming in to him in the Kremlin from his services before the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union. Operation Barbarossa in 1941. Incredibly brave agents working for the Soviet services risked their lives, literally, to provide him warnings about the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union. And what did Stalin do? He dismissed them out of hand. Not only that, in some of the instances, and I quote a few in the book, he actually denounced the spy agency, he denounced the agents as disinformers who were, one quote was, this person isn't an agent, he's a lying son of a bitch, and even more explicit language. So to answer your question, within the Soviet architecture of leadership and intelligence, personalities are absolutely essential. Of course, that's the same in Western liberal democracies as well. There is, however, although it's far from perfect, and there have been extraordinary episodes when intelligence has become politicized in the West, and when Western services failed to live up to what they're supposed to do. But there is an effort by Western services to tell truth to power. And that is, at least in the US context and in the UK context, that's seen as the absolute fundamental purpose of any of intelligence. It's to deliver information to leaders. And often that information is exactly what they don't want to hear. And that's really the purpose of intelligence. And at key points, we find that in the UK, its intelligence services did that effectively. And crucially, the leadership was willing to listen to it. So this happened in particular, just to mention one example that comes to mind, was the intelligence from MI6's agent within the KGB, Oleg Gordievsky, in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And what he revealed from deep inside the KGB was that actually the Soviet leadership was extraordinarily fearful and afraid of the US and President Reagan at the time. So this cut against the traditional thinking of the US and British intelligence, which was that the Soviet Union, for all of their rhetoric and their bluster, they were not afraid of the US, that they were just as strong. You know, that was all what their rhetoric wanted to say. But in fact, what Gordievsky was saying is that they view the West, they view the West with a great deal of fear. And that really, as I said, cut against the grain. And critically, the Prime Minister at the time, Margaret Thatcher, and Reagan were willing to listen to that and altered their position regarding the Soviet Union accordingly.
One of the most fascinating aspects of this book is that you highlight the irony between Western intelligence successes against Nazi Germany, but its subsequent failures in collecting information about the Soviet Union and its intentions. What factors contributed to this shift in intelligence effectiveness? I really found that part of the book fascinating.
That transition from the Second World War, World War, to Cold War really is striking, isn't it? And I'm glad that I'm glad to hear that you found that interesting, because I found it striking. And one of the questions I was asking while writing the book was, well, what was going on in terms of the British and the American services during the Second World War, when the Soviet Union was, after all, supposedly allies with the West? What was going on in terms of any assessments about the latent looming threat of the Soviet Union, and indeed, more importantly, the specific threat of Soviet espionage? And what we find is that actually it was just a matter of necessity that, yes, there were some assessments by Britain's services, for example, that did alert its readers to the long-term threat of the Soviet Union, that to quote one report, it hasn't changed its stripes, that it's going to be the same beast after the war as it was before. But all of the resources, this is, you know, the Western allies were fighting a war for Western civilization against, that's not an overstatement, against Nazi Germany and the Axis powers. All of the resources and the machinery of their intelligence establishment were thrown at defeating the Axis powers. And whatever threat the Soviet Union posed would just simply have to be dealt with at another point in the future after the defeat of the Axis. So what we find then is, of course, from the Soviet perspective, when all of the Western defenses were and security were focused on the Axis powers, this was a golden opportunity for Soviet services to go on the offensive and to embed spies and to collect, steal scientific and technical intelligence across fields, all the while Western services were consumed and distracted in their hot war against the Axis powers. And John, this it seems to me, has an echo with events closer to our own time with Russia and China. But maybe we'll come back to that in a subsequent question.
Well, I was just about to ask, like, how did these failures, as outlined in the book, lay the groundwork for Putin's espionage strategies against the West in the years that followed?
Yeah. Well, what I think we're talking about in many ways is the short-termism of Western services. We find that repeatedly, that it's we're very good, the UK services anyway, historically, are very good once there's a crisis of realigning resources, throwing resources at a threat, and then collecting on it. What Western services like the Brits and the Americans are less good at is long-term threat analysis and allocation of resources. So what did Putin learn from this period? Well, Putin, of course, being a KGB officer himself, knows the history of Russian services intimately. And indeed, since he came to power, there have been series and series of books and hagiography written about Russia's services, past and present. So he's lived and breathed this history, and he knows it only too well. What lessons would he have taken? Well, of course, impossible to know. He hasn't sort of, you know, written this expressly, but it's quite clear when we look at what Russian services under Putin have been doing for the subsequent two decades, then in many ways it's the same strategy of what Stalin services did during the Second World War. There's a parallel there. And I think it stems from Putin's understanding of history and application of history. That's to say, when Western powers were distracted, consumed, and throwing their resources at one area on the left, this was the moment for him, for the Kremlin, to strike on the right. So post 9/11, the overwhelming resources that the UK and the US intelligence services threw at counterterrorism. This was a moment of, we can now see, I think it's safe to say, American overstretch. And it was this moment when Russian services proactively went on the offensive against Western powers when their resources were being dedicated elsewhere. I mean, there's just some, John, there's some striking and absolutely really humiliating statistics that have been publicly released recently about the level of resources that UK services were throwing at counterterrorism, so as opposed to hostile states. So in about 2006, it was somewhere around 95% of MI5's workload was devoted to counterterrorism. And that's in the face of very real, clear and present threats, terrorist plots, understandably so. But only leaving only 5% of resources, work resources left for all other hostile states. You can see now, against that kind of like harsh data, that statistic, of how it was in many ways easy pickings, low-hanging fruit for hostile state services, particularly Russia and China. And it's at exactly this moment that I think that we find a hardening of their intelligence services, Russian and Chinese, against Western powers.
Because they behave in a different way. They see these as opportunities to be exploited. And that really does become very clear when you look at this from a historical perspective and you look at it in a much, I suppose, with a greater overview of what happens and what does happen.
I think that's right, John. Yeah. I mean, one of the FSB Russian service defectors who I interviewed for the book, who actually comes from a sort of very long line of Soviet intelligence officers' family. There was no other choice for him but to join Russian intelligence in the 1990s, which he dutifully did before becoming totally despondent and defecting to the US. In the interviews I had with him of his training and then work in the late 1990s, early 2000s, just as Putin came in, he said that the sort of striking quote he gave me was that Russian services, their only restraint on undertaking an operation is whether it can be effective. Never any kind of legal or ethical or any other kind of consideration comes into play. It's just, can we operationally carry this out? And that, it has to be said, is in such stark contrast to Western services, which operate under, obviously, a rule of law and oversight, and indeed have people like yourself, John, investigative journalists, investigating their activities and asking awkward questions. All of that is missing in Russia and China. And so what do we see? We see intelligence services from their intelligence services operating with a ruthlessness that shows itself in the public domain, in key episodes, the Skripal poisoning, Litvinenko assassination. But there is a subterranean continuation of that between those episodes which flash up in the public domain.
What's really fascinating about this work is how everything is suddenly put into context. And I felt when I was reading it, that I began to look at issues in a slightly different way, because to see the future, you really do need sometimes to look to the past. So your book traces the origins of the Cold War for Stalin, well before the establishment of the CIA. Could you elaborate on how the US and the UK, through leaders like Churchill and Eisenhower, that they leveled that playing field with espionage operations? Because, and I really want to be careful here, I'm not trying to portray this book as a historic work. Everything is very relevant to what's happening in modern times, but it puts everything in context. Could you maybe talk the listeners through that, Colin?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. I think the striking thing about when the CIA was established, strikingly late, actually, when it, compared to other powers, 1947. So Russian services, Soviet services, had been busily, doing everything they could to embed agents in critical points, places within the Western hallways of power, including in the Oval Office. They've been doing that in the preceding decades. And it wasn't until 1947 that the US government got around to actually setting up a dedicated intelligence service, the CIA. And what did the CIA experience after it was set up? A succession of absolute catastrophic human intelligence failures, as well as Britain services, with the revelation of the spy networks like the Cambridge Five, and then a succession of other traitors within its services. So it became pretty stark, pretty blindingly obvious that in terms of human intelligence, the Soviets were outgunning Western services, left, right, and center in the years after the Second World War. It seemed to be one spy scandal after another. And meanwhile, CIA and other Western services like Britain's Foreign Service, MI6, were trying their best to collect on the Soviet Union, but it was a next to impossible effort with the police states behind the Iron Curtain. So what does Eisenhower, and this is gets to your point about leadership. Eisenhower, of course, knew the power and the significance of intelligence from his time during the Second World War, leading Allied troops into Europe. He knew about the power of code breaking from Bletchley Park, the ultra secret. Well, when he became president, he knew that technical intelligence could help resolve problems that human intelligence couldn't. And he threw a monumental amount of resources at technical intelligence collection capabilities. This was building, state-of-the-art early computers that were given to the US NSA, as well as funding CIA spy airplane programs like the U-2 reconnaissance mission. So basically, he realized quite rightly that human intelligence can provide material that other forms of technical intelligence collection can't do. You know, what a leader is thinking, his or her innermost thoughts. But that is far easier said than done, as I don't need to tell your listeners. And so Eisenhower realized that the way for the US to try to collect reliable intelligence on the Soviets was through technical intelligence collection. And the U-2 spy plane is a sort of shining example of that. It gets back to your question about leadership, and there's a striking a role of leadership by Eisenhower when it came to intelligence.
This book delves into the CIA's recruitment of Soviet military intelligence officers, including Mr. Popov. How did such daring espionage operations contribute to saving billions of dollars in military research and development for the US? Some of this is really fascinating in terms of the wealth that is derived from good intelligence operations.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on the recruitment of human agents, so you mentioned Popov, there was also Oleg Penkovsky, who was a key Western CIA and MI6 agent, run deep within Soviet military intelligence, the GRU, and his intelligence proved to be absolutely critical during the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. We can see that now, how his intelligence and the code names that it produced, it contributed directly to assessments of the Soviet nuclear weapons of missiles placed in Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis, those assessments that ended up on JFK's desk in the Oval Office. So this was a striking example of how human intelligence, CIA recruitment, MI6 recruitment of this agent contributed to decision-making at the highest level. Later on in the Cold War, the CIA managed to recruit agents that gave a sort of granular look at how the Soviet intelligence was collecting in a kind of massive effort to steal as much scientific and technical intelligence as possible from the US in the 1970s and 80s. This was a moment of detente, a thawing of relations between East and West, in which the successive White House administrations hoped that by opening up commercial relations with the Soviet bloc, that would help to reform the Soviet bloc from the inside. Well, the KGB saw this as an opportunity to exploit and steal as much secrets as possible. Now, a series of well-placed agents inside, behind the Iron Curtain, revealed to the CIA what the KGB was doing. And then this is a really striking episode, it seems to me, given with echoes for today. The Reagan administration then went one step further. They knew what sectors and what companies were being targeted by the KGB. And what did they then decide to do? They decided to sabotage those supply chains, those secrets that they knew were being stolen by the Soviets, by inserting malware into software that was being stolen, by inserting blueprints for technological developments that would then backfire and go wrong once it ended up in the Soviet Union. So there was a practical immediate effect of sabotaging Soviet research and development projects from the inside by sabotaging the material that they were stealing. but it also led to a significant reassessment of where the Soviets actually stood in the arms race with the West. And it contributed, I think it's fair to say, to Reagan understanding that they were, the Soviet economy, the Soviet research and development was lagging behind, and that what he could do was to simply outgun and throw more resources at an arms race and a space race, which he knew the Soviets couldn't keep up with. So it's a striking there are threads here which sort of espionage in the dark shadows of this world that you and I are both interested in contributes to really strategic thinking at the highest possible levels in decision makers in the West.
One of the real good aspects of this book is that it also highlights the limitations of intelligence, and specifically about something like the Cuban arms crisis. Can you discuss the inherent challenges that intelligence faces, even when the resolution is successful?
So the limitations of intelligence, the phrase that comes to mind is you can only bring a horse to the water. You can't force the horse to drink. And we find that time and time again, that if there is good, reliable, timely intelligence that's been collected and assessed and delivered to decision makers, ultimately, that is just one source for decision makers to make a decision. And it's, I guess, their prerogative to dismiss it if they so desire. It's probably a foolish decision to do so. We find that historically. But nonetheless, that's the way it works in the West. So during the Cuban Missile Crisis, there seems to have been a really striking success, I would say, of the way the Kennedy administration was prepared to listen to intelligence that was collected from Penkovsky, as I just mentioned, a human agent. But also, we can now see technical intelligence collection, codebreakers, NSA decrypts, assisted by GCHQ. And this was a combination of intelligence from across different fields that fed into the assessments that formed an absolutely sort of critical bedrock for Kennedy's decision-making during the crisis. But other instances that I sketch in the book of moments when, I mean, one example again, we've already talked about it, but just worth emphasizing again, of during the Second World War, of warning alarm bells being rung about the extent to which the Soviet Union, Stalin's Soviet Union and his services, were not really the allies that he wanted to present them to be, and that the West should think of them as, and that they were going to be the West's long-term enemy after the Second World War. Well, yes, that is, you know, you can see that was sort of job done. They provided their warnings, but what was the result? Well, excuse me, we're fighting a war against Nazi Germany, and just can't actually devote any resources to this, not least because the Foreign Office, the British Foreign Office, there's a memo which is just sort of that I found writing the book, which is just kind of like hand sweating in hindsight, which is basically states allies don't spy on allies, and we're not going to be collecting on the Soviet Union now that the Soviets are our allies. Well, I mean, if there had been a bit more practical thinking in the Foreign Office saying, hang on, it's okay for allies to spy on allies, then actually a lot of the catastrophic intelligence failures in the subsequent post-war years perhaps could have been avoided. So a sobering tale of actually It's probably a good idea for allies to collect on allies, especially if your ally is a state like the Soviet Union. So that's sort of seems to me a sort of how I would think about you know, the effectiveness and how intelligence can in many ways help shape decision makers thinking, but ultimately it's up to the decision makers themselves to take it or reject it.
I think you've really highlighted the importance of unbiased reporting and collection of intelligence information. And I think anyone who reads this book will certainly come to the conclusion very, very fast that it's really important to have sort of very rounded, very distilled, and very, I suppose, considered analysis of information that's collected that really is important, and it does shine true.
And the specter of Iraq and WMD that still looms large in Western, certainly in the UK, and then here in the US, where I'm speaking from, it's still in terms of analysis and the absolute across the board intelligence failures in terms of collection, failures in terms of analysis and then dissemination to policymakers. That was a sort of a perfect storm of intelligence failures, of the miscalculation of Iraq's WMD. You're absolutely right that that's the high ideals of what if intelligence is effective, that it should be objective and assessed and delivered, and then ideally you have a decision maker who is willing to listen to that intelligence, even if he or she disagrees with it. But there are certainly, as we all know, moments in the recent past and then further back in history where that absolutely has not been the case. But as with everything, it's a learning process for democracies.
Calder, I've just some final questions.
Yeah.
Reading this book, I had forgotten, or maybe overlooked, or I'm just maybe possibly used to this. I'd forgotten the sort of lengths that Russia's services will go to spread disinformation and to cause chaos. And we've all heard the terms of agents of chaos, etc.
Yeah.
But there were a couple of stories which really jumped out at me. And one was about their involvement in spreading disinformation about the link between AIDS and HIV.
Yeah.
And the very significant consequences of that operation, and how it's implications are really still being felt to this day. Could you just talk the listeners through that particular episode?
Yeah, it's a sobering and pretty disgusting episode. It really is. So in the early 1980s, as this unknown virus, this unknown disease, AIDS, was spreading, the KGB seized on the opportunity to really exploit existing grievances, particularly in the US, in the African American community, and their suspicion of public health bodies. There have been horrendous cases of where African American men have been experimented on, and the U.S. public health system had really exploited them in the past. So there was this latent suspicion of the U.S. government, quote unquote, at large, and public health. And what the KGB did extraordinarily successfully is to spread disinformation that the AIDS disease, the AIDS virus, was a man-made bioweapon that had been developed by the US military at a facility in Fort Detrick in Maryland, that it had escaped, that the US government had been experimenting on prisoners, and that this bioweapon was then spread and was targeting in particular African-American populations. Now this, we can see the mechanics now of how the KGB went about doing this. And it was actually the KGB Soviet program for so-called active measures, and one of the many active measures was disinformation. This was a machine that was churning out what we would call today fake news, left, right, and center. And they, of course, didn't know what was going to stick and what was going to get traction in the target audiences. But in this instance, they hit the right thing at the right time. And we can see how there was a delay, and we can see the mechanics of how they spread this, with the story being inserted into a Soviet-friendly obscure journal. I think it was in India, then got picked up by some press in left-leaning, we would call them, I think it's fair to call them, useful idiots in the West, that then spread this and recycled this message about the AIDS disease. And then it got picked up by the mainstream news. And then it went, what's the phrase? It went viral. That's a terrible pun. But anyway, it went viral, this news. And it received headline news in several, even conservative media outlets in the West in the 1980s. As you just illustrated, this had a huge public health impact, particularly in developing countries in Africa, where they rejected the scientific research saying linking HIV and AIDS, because they said, well, this is just a bioweapon, and that we don't need to. There is no link between HIV and AIDS. That was part of the theme of the Soviet disinformation, and this had an absolutely horrendous impact on public health in some African countries' audiences, and still lingers to this day. But the striking thing, John, about that. And I should say that after 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the new director of the Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR, admitted the KGB's hand in spreading that disinformation story about AIDS. But the really striking thing is that when COVID struck, Russian services unsurprisingly recycled the same conspiracy theory about AIDS, now about COVID, said that it was a bioweapon that had been manufactured by the US military. But what was even more striking was that the Chinese government also recycled that. And not only that, they actually said it was developed in the same facility, Fort Detrick in Maryland, as the KGB had previously said the AIDS virus was manufactured. So there was literally, John, cut and paste an old conspiracy theory to a new conspiracy theory about COVID, that it was a bioweapon developed by the US military, which was allowed to escape, when in fact, as we all know, it was, let's just put this neutrally, COVID arose from China. Whether it was a synthetically developed disease that escaped from a lab, that's a whole issue that we'll probably never will get to the bottom of. But nonetheless, there's this repackaging of an old conspiracy theory, but in an absolutely new way, in a new context of social media, which allowed this conspiracy theory, as with so much in our world today, the lies to spread more quickly and more, I would argue, effectively than the rather simple ways that they spread disinformation in the past. So I'm left with the conclusion, looking at that what's old is new again. And that certainly seems to be one of the themes that I came to at the end of the book, which is we're seeing a lot of repackaging of old strategies, old techniques, but being updated for the new world, a digital world that we're living in. And I think just to sort of emphasize the point, I think that we can't understand what we're seeing unfold in front of us with Russia's services, with China's services, without understanding their past, because they themselves understand their past very well. And it would be foolish for us not to do the same.
Finally, Calder, what insights does the history of espionage provide for understanding, I suppose, current Russian and Chinese efforts in using asymmetric espionage? What advantage does it provide to China and Russia? Because this book really is a beacon. It's a warning about what's possibly coming down the line, or indeed what many people would argue is already here.
Well, I think that, let's put it this way. I think that the history of this, of espionage, shows how intelligence agencies are at the sharp end of the sword in terms of geopolitics. And the issues that they're confronting often take time to trickle into the public domain. And we found that, as we mentioned in this conversation, in the Second World War, that actually, when you look at it from Soviet intelligence perspective, the West was already in a Cold War before they knew it. And then it just took time for them to figure out the extent to which the Soviet services had been working against them during the Second World War. And it seems to me that we're in exactly the same situation with Russia's services and China's services at the moment, that we're now finally, at least here in the US and in the UK, there's a public policy awareness of the extent to which Russia's services, yes, but perhaps even more so, China's services have been exploiting, stealing intellectual property in any and every way possible from Western service, from Western countries, over the past decade and more. While, as I mentioned earlier, resources and attention was diverted elsewhere. So what does this show? It shows that actually we can be in a geopolitical clash before we know it, and that what we need to be alert to is longer term threats that are already sort of already on the scene and will only continue to get more important. So the technologies, basically, John, the technologies that are going to change all of our lives this century: artificial intelligence, quantum computing, and synthetic biology, bioengineering. We are dealing with the here and now, right now, with Russia's war in Ukraine, and quite rightly so, and quite understandably so. But it's those technologies that are going to absolutely change the way all of us live our lives. And it is absolutely the case that Russia's services, but more importantly, China's services, are squarely targeting all of those technologies that are being developed in the West. So this is the moment, it seems to me, where policymakers in Western countries, for once, need to actually grapple with longer term issues beyond the here and now. And it really, it seems to me, John, is about securing intellectual property in the private sector in Western countries, be it in Dublin, be it in London, or in the US in Silicon Valley. It's all part of the same conversation. And it seems to me that the private sector, to say nothing of governments, are approaching, only now beginning to approach and to build safeguards as for hostile states stealing their intellectual property. The real question is whether the horse has already bolted and left the stable, and can we actually get our hands on that horse? that's already left.
On that note, I'd like to conclude this super episode of The Dark State. I'd like to extend my deepest gratitude to Calder Walden for guiding us through a labyrinth of intelligence warfare. I can't recommend Spies enough. It really is a seminal work, and it's a very important book. It not only uncovers the secrets of the past, but also serves as a beacon for understanding the ongoing role of intelligence in the face of conflict and competition between autocracies and democracies. So until we speak again, do take care.